Ladies and gentlemen, it being 11 o'clock, can I welcome you all to the Audit Committee? We have apologies from Councillor Muirhead and Councillor Thompson. Order of business. It's a large number of papers today, most of which are what I call navel-gazing, looking at the structures of local authorities, the structure of our internal audit plan, and there's one substantive paper at the end which will be held in private. Are there any other changes to the order of business? Councillor Baxter.
Yeah, can I just comment that item 5 says papers to follow. I didn't receive any papers.
Yes, I should explain that matter is still under consideration by the executives and will be coming forward to the next meeting, and there are discussions already in place as to the significance of the risk management register to the Audit Committee. Declarations of interest. Minutes of the meeting of 17th March. There's a typo on page 5, item 7, the middle bullet point. It should be total cost per attendance at sports facilities. So we noted a relatively high in Midlothian. The word care should come out.
Sorry. I recall that I raised, and it's not in the minutes, the issue of the lay member.
Kenneth?
Yes, that was discussed at the end of the meeting, which I think is probably why it isn't recorded in the minutes. But there was we did have a discussion, and given that the point has been raised, Chair, if I may, that we will be going out to advertisement later this month, and I will advise members of the audit committee when we do that, so that if they know people that would be interested in applying, they can encourage them to do so.
Councillor Bryant.
I'd like to ask Kenneth, why is it taking so long?
Well, I think we felt it was appropriate to do it, leave some time after the previous unsuccessful campaign. I think I said at the last committee we were intending to do it in the spring, when the general election is out of the way. That's what we'll do.
On item 6, we did agree that we would change the cycle of committee meetings for the audit committee. And this, of course, will have a knock-on effect of producing new and different dates for our diaries. My understanding is that the council will have to formally approve this change, and at that point, then consideration will be given to the scheduling of the meetings. Do I take it that the minutes can now be adopted? There being no item 5, item 6, Audit Scotland report. In the past, we've had access to these reports. On this occasion, we are now having a précis created for us on a couple of them. And the first one, Kenneth, I think you want to talk to the overview paper on local government in Scotland, pages 7 to 20.
Yes, thank you. Chair, this is a report which is produced by the Accounts Commission on an annual basis, and really it's a high-level and independent reflection on the issues that have emerged from local authority audits during the year in question. And I always think there's some value in bringing this forward to the Audit Committee and bringing it to the attention of members, because whilst I would hope that no member reading this report would see anything which necessarily surprised them, given that, you know, the key messages round about, you know, finance and performance and reporting and quality of service are ones that are reflected in many of the reports that come forward to the Council, the Cabinet and other committees. I do think it is useful for members to see the general picture of challenges which face local authorities, and any of you who have taken the time to look at the more detailed report will know there's a lot of interesting information in there, particularly around about financial context. That has been the primary concern of the Accounts Commission over an extended period, and that remains the case. And in this report, we've summarised in sections 2.4 to 2.7 some of the issues around about the financial context, which are set out in the report. And then at 2.8, we reflect the issues that relate to how councils are managing the financial challenges. And again, I think that these are issues which hopefully are not unfamiliar to any members. There are a number of recommendations in the report. There's seven recommendations set out at paragraph 3 of the covering report, and there's some comment in relation to each of them in relation to what this council is doing to meet these challenges. And really, this is all about building on our financial strategy, which is regularly brought forward to council, and also our transformation programme, and ensuring that we're reshaping that and building on that in order to meet the many challenges that we face. And there will be a further report in terms of the next stages coming forward to the June Council, and that is referenced in the report. The Accounts Commission report also includes a self-assessment tool which is designed to help councillors review progress in implementing the recommendations in the report. And we've attached that as an appendix to the report. And it raises a number of questions for councillors to consider in terms of the governance and management of the council and the reports and information that are brought forward to councillors. I think that's quite a useful thing for councillors to look at. And as we move forward with further training sessions for the Audit Committee, we might use this sort of documentation to consider how we wish to work in the future. I'm happy to take any questions, Chair.
Councillor De Vink.
I think this paper is a very significant paper, and I have to say that I don't like any of it, because what is really happening is that the government, the Scottish Government, is trying to put an extraordinary amount of responsibility on us as members of the Audit Committee, and we ought to be very aware of what is happening. And I would like to go, if I may, through the recommendations of the Chief Executive, and I want to really raise, first of all, under 3.1.1, elected members currently have access to collective development and all of that, and I am going to be so rude and so offensive as to suggest that currently there are a number of members that really are part of the Audit Committee who will fail on that particular issue. Then I go to the next page, where I have a big question mark under 2, and the italics, further improvements to the information provided to members as part of the existing governance arrangements for scrutiny is expected as part of the ongoing review of the planning and performance management framework. This refreshed reporting expecting during the 15-16 performance cycle. I just put a big question mark on that. It goes over my head. Then under 3, Midlothian currently works with its community planning partners. I just thought that was waffle. I just couldn't believe what I was reading. And then we come to page number 4. This recommendation should be more fully addressed by the adoption of the Delivering Excellence framework noted above. I just don't think it is in existence. And then whilst the delivery under 5 framework will certainly further address, I put another big question mark. I honestly have grave, grave misgivings about this paper, and I want to go through subsequently the appendix, because I have answered some of the questions that are being asked, and you won't like what I've got to say, but it has to be said.
gosh, I mean, every council in Scotland presumably has received this paper and will be having similar discussions to us. And I concur that a lot of the wording is waffly and subjective, and quite possibly the purpose is for the Scottish Government and Audit Scotland to push responsibility down to councillors for proper governance. But insofar as the wording is quite approximate and aspirational, then maybe there's no problem with us responding to it in a similar way.
Well, that's very encouraging, but we should stand up as Midlothian and say, look, we don't agree with it. I mean, I certainly won't agree. And if this is adopted, I will resign from the Audit Committee because I cannot take on that responsibility. And if those responsibilities are given, then we should be paid a very significant additional fee for being on this committee, or those that remain wish to remain on this committee.
Yeah, some of the wording can be read as impossible councils of perfection. But it's not, an issue, correct me, Kenneth, if I'm wrong, of us adopting this paper. We are simply noting it, is my understanding.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I mean, that is correct. I mean, we bring forward the overview of local government report to this committee every year. And the reason we do that is because it's telling us about the challenges that local government is facing. And I think it's important that as members, you know, you're aware of that. And I suppose a couple of comments, really. I mean, my first comment, which I think I said in my introduction, is that there's nothing in the overview report that as a council we're not aware of. Nothing. I mean, it talks about the scale of the financial challenge. That's the primary focus of it. It talks about the demand placed on council services, and we know about that. There's nothing new, I think, in the overview of local government report. And the other thing, which I hope members would be reasonably familiar with, is the attempts by this council to address the challenges which it faces. And these are taken forward through the financial strategy, through our delivery of the Single Midlothian Plan, through our business transformation programme. And we know that in terms of delivery, this council has a record of improving outcomes in recent years, there's no doubt about that, and also that we're doing that in the context of a reducing financial envelope. So, I mean, I think we have, you know, a record of delivery which is strong. None of that is to underestimate the scale of the challenge we face in common with all other councils in Scotland. But, I mean, frankly, at the moment, I think our position, whilst challenging, is favourable compared to other councils who members will see the degree of their financial difficulties set out in the national press. So, I mean, this is for noting. It's about setting out the challenges. We need to continue to respond to these challenges, and our responses to the recommendations are a statement of intent that we do intend to continue to robustly deal with the challenges we face as a council.
I clearly read in this paper that we are going to be expected to take on a much greater responsibility than has been outlined before.
Our responsibilities continue to be those relating to the terms of reference. That's a Midlothian Council document. But insofar as I read this, in broad terms, we are conforming with it. So not really, I think, a case for declaring war on Audit Scotland. The one thing I did like it in it, they do say councillors need clearer information, perhaps rather paradoxically. And I think everyone around this table believes there's too much verbiage in the work that we do here and not enough detailed figure work.
Well, that's being raised in a subsequent paper that we will see later on, but I would value it if we could go over Appendix 1.
Without stopping a discussion of this, and this is a voluntary sort of self-examination questionnaire, designed to get the grey cells moving. Now, when we have a new independent member, it may be an appropriate time, almost 2 years since we last had a training half day for this committee, and it may be at that point, as Ken has suggested, this exercise will have much more focus from the point of view of councillors, and we can use it then. But nobody is obliged at all to undergo the exercise of trying to respond to these questions at the moment. No doubt it would do no harm if we did, but there'll be a more focused opportunity later in the year. Councillor Baxter.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I share some of the concerns that Councillor Devine refers to there. That, you know, if you look at the questionnaire in the appendix, it's certainly true that officers give us as much information as we perhaps would need, but we might not understand it.
Exactly.
If they gave it to us in Greek, they would be giving us the information, but if you don't speak Greek, it's not much use. And I think that's the problem we as councillors have, is that I think, and I don't just say this about Midlothian, I think that's true across the whole of the UK, councillors have a very poor understanding of how council accounts run. I've got a basic understanding, and I think many of my colleagues do as well, but we tend to understand it as much as we need to. We rely very much on trust that the information we're given, and I'm thinking specifically when we come to the budget at the end of the year, we take it on trust that these figures stack up and the risks are as we're being told, but we don't perhaps understand how the accounts could be run, the changes that we could make, the risks that that would be involved in making those decisions. And it's a case when it comes to the budget, the most important part of the year financially, that we take on trust what the officers say, and then we'll perhaps tinker with it and say, well, if we take this money from doing to do this, then where will it come from? What is the impact of those movements? But we don't get to understand the basics. That's why I've asked for, as part of the elected member development, that we do start to address this. And I think it's good that we're recognising these deficiencies. And what I would like to ask is that within the recommendations, point one, it refers to that. And I have been told it will be after the recess, which is fine. But if we could schedule that perhaps well in advance of the budget making process so that we have as much information to hand as possible to inform any decisions we take as part of that.
Yes, that seems a very logical proposal. Kenneth?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a sensible thing to do. And I mean, I suppose what recommendation one is saying, and what we've tried to encourage members to do, is tell us what they think the development and training needs are. So I do welcome it when councillors do come back on that. I mean, I think our general finding would be that we don't get a lot of feedback on training needs and requirements. But you know, where councillors do come forward, that is very helpful. And in terms of the appendix from an officer perspective, and I recognise that sometimes that can be quite different. I mean, none of these issues that are raised in the appendix are things that aren't under consideration. I wouldn't say we're in a great position in relation to all of them, but again, none of them are issues which are out with our consideration, because they're precisely the kinds of questions that in terms of managing and leading the authority, we need to be considering on a week-in, week-out basis. I do think the issue about ensuring that, you know, members are given the information and training and updates that they require is important, but we absolutely rely on members telling us what these are.
Councillor Zvink?
Could I... just because I'm so inept, could I be told who is exactly the Section 95 officer?
That's a position I hold, Councillor De Vink.
Who is the monitoring officer?
That position is now held by Alan Turpey, the legal services manager, Alan Turpey.
Oh, Alan, yeah, okay. And the chief social work officer?
That's Alison White. The head of adult services.
Now,
Alison,
how many
White.
Of us knew that? Did you know that?
I knew the first two, I wasn't sure.
Well, the first one, maybe. But the fact that we don't know that is an awful situation.
in my eyes.
I think it all leads to the need out of the format of this committee to have a solid half day at least just reviewing the fundamental constructs of Middle Lothian Council and the basic financial controls that we have and many of the issues in this appendix. But I can see that as a document landing on your desk, it was not a very welcome one.
I didn't quite catch. Alison? White. I must try and meet her. I know both Gary and Alan Turpey, but I don't know Alison White. Is she here?
John?
Just for the matter of the record, it's my recollection, and I'm almost 100% certain this, I wrote to all members following the last appointments of statutory officers. I do recollect doing that following the management review. So just for since this is a public meeting, a matter of public record, I think it's important I put that marker down.
Well, it's striking. Maybe Councillor Milliken is the only one that knew, but my two colleagues here on my left didn't know.
Maybe there's an issue of information overload going on that, again, is a topic we need to discuss in some other venue. Councillor Milligan?
Yeah, I concur with what John says. We were saying the new structures out when the new appointments were were made, because there was quite a few questions about who would be the one an officer, because it sat with Hilary Kelly before that. A bit like Peter, I think the area is going to concern me, the area that probably does concern me and that I would maybe agree with, is when you read 3.11, assess whether they have the appropriate knowledge and experience in areas such as assessing financial and service priority to carry out the roles effectively. Half-day training 2 to 3 times a year isn't going to give us that experience, and my experience of that, being here since 1999, is once you've had it a couple of times, it starts to become repetitive, and there's such a various and variant ways that reports are put together, and I sometimes feel that once you start to get your head around how these reports are being presented, that somebody comes along and changes the way that they're then laid out and set out, and various people have their ways of working. And I didn't actually ever think, apart from maybe people who have financial backgrounds, professional backgrounds and that you're ever going to be in a position where lay elected members will be able to say, I have the expertise to deal with this.
Yeah, I concur. I mean, this back to this, you know, councils of perfection that no human being can achieve. This whole issue of rendering information accessible is a problem in the private and the public sectors, but we come back to, you know, the statement that I think we all buy into, councillors need clearer information. I still think we should have a half day to stand back from the day-to-day activities of this committee, but there may also be a wider issue across Scottish local government about the manner and nature of information and the English that is used. Plain English would be a good idea, and fewer words and more numbers. This is for noting. There are recommendations. I understand the problems we all have in relating to the questionnaire at the back. However, I think we should probably move the meeting on, having had that useful discussion. Can I now ask Gary to talk to the Audit Scotland report, the overview of local government in Scotland? The Scotland's public finances, 21 to 31.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, this report brings the committee again for noting the report, Scotland's public finances, a follow-up audit. The report itself is available on the Accounts Commission website and really sets out two main parts. It gives the overview of the current financial position that the public sector faces, and then sets out how, in part two of the report, how public bodies such as Midlothian Council are meeting the challenges of reduced spend and how they're proceeding with considering longer-term financial planning. As was that long, we saw it in the earlier paper, but the issue of longer-term financial planning and is fine in theory, but in practice we now sit where we live year to year, particularly in our general fund services, where we're reliant on the annual and we're back to an annual spending review by Scottish Government. Just to share with members the challenge ahead, we're expecting the UK Government, depending on what happens on Thursday, to probably set its spending review around about September, Scottish Government to follow in October, with the local government settlement in December. So the time and the flow of information in terms of the 16-17 financial year is going to be extremely demanding in terms of having an assessment of how much money we're going to get from government. So just, you know, when you talk about longer-term financial planning, important to put it in that context that we are very much at the behest of the higher levels of government in terms of what they do with their spending plans and their financial planning. Again, like the previous report, this report has a checklist to support members stepping back and scrutinising and the position, and that's attached as an appendix. Section 2.2 of the report sets out the overview of the challenges, and again, reflecting on the previous report, there's nothing in there that's a surprise, nothing new. They're all issues that we know about and are doing our very best as officers and as elected members to address. Part 1, Section 2.3 and 2.4 sets out the Audit Scotland's view of the financial position, and I suppose economists and there's various commentaries in terms of the prospects for public sector to finances. But ultimately, we won't know the position for 16-17 until December this year. Section 2 sets how we can get the most from our budgets in terms of budget and longer-term financial planning. And again, information to allow scrutiny of spending plans, which members have touched on in the earlier report, and the importance of having the right information and having it in a language which you understand and can follow. We set out in Section 3 Midlothian's position in terms of the issues. We have a budget for this year. And we've got indicative budgets for the following 2 years based on a number of key assumptions, and we still have a deficit to address in 17-18. We'll bring forward a report to Council in the June cycle in terms of progress. As a Council, we've got very strong capital plans. You've got multi-year capital plans in place for general services and for housing, and the housing model is based on longer-term projections, and that's what sort of drives and supports your investment in new council housing. So that's a very much in terms of longer term financial planning, a success where that planning has allowed you to make important investment decisions. All of our budgets are set within the context of the financial strategy you approved some time ago back in February 14, and we continue to work against that backdrop. Council does have the scrutiny arrangements in place to allow proper governance around its financial affairs through this committee, through scrutiny committee and at council itself. And I suppose touching on earlier points, it's how to make the most of those and make sure you've got the information to do that effectively. We can continue to provide, and we have provided briefings on treasury management, and I think I'll pick that up as part of the development work to revisit that after the recess with when we have a new lay member and audit committee. Treasury management is a very important and very complicated part of our financial regime. So really, just that's a very quick overview. Again, the recommendations are really to note the report and perhaps for members of the committee to take away the checklist and pick that up through the training session later in the year alongside the previous checklist. I have to pause there and take any questions, Chair.
Councillor Baxter.
Thank you, Chair. In the light of the timetable for the public spending review that Gary mentioned, I know that we as a council tend to agree our budget at the December meeting. Most councils, it seems to be February, March, which is approaching the deadline. I'm just wondering the reasons for that. Is that a purely political decision? Is there a steer from officers? Would they consider whether we should perhaps put back the budget decision till later in the financial year this year on account of the reasons you gave there, Gary?
Gary?
Yeah, I suppose the only requirement is a statutory requirement to set council tax in a balanced budget by the date of the 11th of March and for the following year. And really in the hands of council, and the administration in terms of the timetable that they wish to adopt. I suppose from an officer perspective, the earlier we can make decisions, then the more time we have to make sure that we can implement them effectively and with appropriate communication with anybody that's affected by the changes. And that certainly in previous years in terms of using December has allowed that through the January-February period to allow us to make sure that there are no shocks for people whose charges or other services change on the 1st of April.
Councillor Devine.
I found this a very interesting report, and particularly the appendix I found fascinating, and I have filled it all in. It makes grim reading. But I would like to, just before we go on to that, I would like to raise the issue of the staggering 9% cut in the public sector spending in Scotland since 2009, 2010. I mean, 9%. It really takes your breath away. But what I really also would have liked to have seen is the increase in the expenditure of, 9% is one thing, but we have had very significant increases in cost, things due to the demographics that I keep mentioning, and also other costs that are beyond our control. So if we could have a figure that reflects that position, the difference between 9% and the increase of our cost will make it probably even more staggering, and it would be helpful for us to have that figure.
Harry?
I suppose those, in terms of the position nationally in terms of the Scottish Government's budget, the local impact of that is set out and was set out lastly for you in the February Council in terms of the financial strategy report. So that shows the impact on costs, whether it's pay, the demographics that you rightly touch on, Councillor Devine, school roles, etc. The other national pressures that flow through, for example, changes at the last minute in teachers' pensions and in national insurance. That's a very complicated picture, but it is set out in the financial strategy report, and again, happy to talk through members through that. I suppose the challenge is 9% talks about real terms, so that we've been over that period, and what we've seen is that one of our key costs has gone up by lower than the inflationary figure that's used to assess real terms. So pay has been going up at a maximum of 1%, which has been lower than the real term reduction in the value of money, and that's been quite a big part of how we've managed to survive over the last few years. That although there's a 9% real term reductions, our costs in respect of pay haven't been going up at an inflationary rate. But happy to, again refer members back to the financial strategy report, which we've tried to lay that out in a consistent manner throughout the budget cycle. And happy to talk to any elected member on the audit committee or any other member in terms of the detail of that report any time.
Councillor Bryant.
Assuming there are further cuts to our income, what impact would that have on our capital plans? For example, are we legally committed to certain expenditure in the future, or will we be able to perhaps not do these capital plans to balance the budget?
Again, as part of the financial strategy, members agreed a cap on the amount of debt that we would carry to fund financial investment in our assets. That then puts a cap on the percent or the extent to which the revenue budget has to fund debt charges. Yes, we have legally committed projects in the capital plan, we're in members' hands in terms of changes that they might wish to make in the capital plan. So it is an option open to you to suspend investment or cease investment in assets to balance the books. But you need to look at that in terms of the options and what it means for your longer term. As members will be fully aware, if you don't invest in your assets, they start to crumble and you end up paying more in the long run. So you need to look at investment very carefully to make sure that you're not addressing the immediate issue, but creating, just stacking up problems for the future. And that'll be, you know, one of the biggest capital investments we have coming in the coming months is the replacement of the New Battle High School. And we know that to build a new school is best for outcomes, is best for the community, and is best financially long term. To not do that, you would be faced with having to put capital and revenue injections into a crumbling building. Sorry.
Just something for the blackboard. I think we're all conscious that Scotland's population has hit an all-time high, and the number I've seen recently from Midlothian indicated in the last 3 years we've gone from 81,000 to 87,000. So we clearly are one of the faster-growing parts of Scotland. And the question in my mind is, ordinarily one would consider more residents here beneficial to the finances of the council because of the additional council tax. But that's only 15% of the revenues of the council, and it may actually be the growing population makes our problems worse by the need to provide more services. I could park that question on the blackboard, perhaps for discussion some other day, as to what the correlation between growing population in Midlothian is and the financial requirements of the council, and whether they are in fact met by the governmental formula. Thank you for that.
Sorry, before you go to the next item, the appendix, what are we... I've filled it all in. Who should I give it to?
Councillor, I think I'm happy to take a... I would welcome a copy of the, your submission, and certainly a food for thought.
Again, this subject area can be covered at our half-day conference later on this year. National Fraud Initiative, we are obliged and indeed happily receive updates at each meeting of the progress of this project.
This report provides an update on the 2014-15 National Fraud Initiative data matching exercise and progress with reviewing the matches identified. The Council uploaded the data in October 2014. The resulting matches were made available to us in January 2015, with a further release of matches in March. There have been 3,302 matches, and so far 3,143 have been reviewed, with no issues identified. 24 were closed after investigation, and 135 are still being checked and investigated. The Audit Committee is asked to note the content of the report and that a further update on the matching process will be provided in September.
This is a very interesting result that there hasn't been a discovery of a great deal of fraud as a result of the matching exercise. In fact, I think what you're saying is none so far.
We have the number of matches that we were given increased dramatically this year because of the high level of creditor matches. And it's in the nature of the creditors that it's a big data set. The vast majority of the increased items have not come upon anything that we hadn't picked up with our own controls. The main matches that may possibly produce evidence of fraud, particularly, may well be in the housing benefit area. And this is a similar level, I think, to previous years. It takes a bit of time to investigate these to identify any levels of fraud that may exist.
Councillor Bryant.
I find this a very confusing table. Does this actually mean there is no fraud? Or if there is, could we have some details of that?
I think what we're saying is no fraud other than the fraud that we were already aware of using our existing systems.
Okay.
Councillor Dwink.
I think it's about 6,500 people.
Heather, I think we're correct in that we'll continue to receive these reports at each meeting, so we'll be able to spot whether or not there's a little tail there that turns out to be a little tougher than the initial sample. Councillor Middleton.
Sorry, I'm kind of lonely over here. I'm actually finding the summary kind of baffling. That we'll take the housing benefit, for example. There's been 857 cases raised of suspect, yet none of them at all so far have come out to be fraudulent activity. Is there something wrong with the way we're doing this? Because it seems to be creating an awful lot of work and taking up an awful lot of time for not just the staff, but for the people who have been investigated, who I've been along with when they've been interviewed, and puts them in a terrified position for quite lengthy periods of time. And we seem to be saying here that out of the 857 people that have been identified using this system, there's none of them at all being guilty of any fraud. There has to be something not working right here.
Well, the 48 were still investigating.
What the 857, this is a computerised match process, so it is simply identifying this household, this address is in receipt of housing benefit, and there's someone at that address is in receipt of a student loan, is working, or is on a payroll elsewhere. So the vast majority of the matches can be eliminated without any, when we say further investigation, the initial investigation is simply looking at it on a screen, comparing it with our data. The vast majority of them are removed at that point. The 48 are ones where there is a potential for fraud in there, and that's where more in-depth investigation. The 48 won't probably all be called in for interview, but we will just look further to see what the details are behind these.
Councillor Middleton.
I understand there's still 48 being investigated, but the fact is that for a whole financial year, we have cleared 809 people, and I understand what you're saying, but there just seems to be a box missing for me that should say prosecuted after investigating, or else that we seem to be doing all this work and there's never anybody prosecuted, because, as I say, there just seems to be that one box that seems to be missing at the end with how many folk we've investigated and then went on to prosecute.
Well, hopefully, by September, when we should be well on with the investigation of the ones which may possibly lead to prosecution, and I expect in September to be able to give further information about actual values of overpayments made and likelihood of prosecutions. But I must say, the investigation process can be quite lengthy.
As I say, I have experience of how long it can take, and as I say, it's frustrating, especially for the people who have been investigated who think they're in the clear. But I'm also very much aware there are several people who had to make huge payments back to the council. I'm not actually sure if this is the way that they were pulled into the system. It's the one thing I don't know. But I just find it doesn't balance out for me that there isn't something there saying that if they're investigating that huge amount of people, that there has to either be something wrong with the way this flags up through the computer, and something needs altered if everybody's innocent, because it's taken up an awful lot of time and money to the council.
Heather, I think you indicated that there are other methodologies within the council for detecting housing benefit fraud and other irregularities. We also have a whistleblowing line. But those instances where we're using, as it were, the conventional methodology, those cases are not captured here.
The matches pick up are merely comparing data appearing on computers. So yes, it does overlap sometimes with other methods that we're using.
So only where there is a data anomaly would that sort of case be caught, but we may well already be acting using conventional methods.
That's true.
Perhaps there's a case for extending this paper to show what the activity using conventional detection methods is as a supplement to the table that you have. And we could perhaps discuss that offline.
Sure.
But could I just really reiterate my point is that really this very hard work on behalf of the officials, I mean, it really de minimis the kind of really unacceptable things that are happening. And as long as those few that are then going to be caught out will be prosecuted, we should be quite impressed by what has been achieved so far.
Yes, I think we, before forming a view as to whether there's a lot of wasted staff time here, we need to work through the tail of cases still under investigation and perhaps get this fuller picture of what the total level of irregularities is for the council. Heather, thank you for that. That's very helpful. Can I now move on to Graham Herbert's internal audit annual assurance report?
Thank you. Yes. Under the public sector internal audit standards, the internal audit manager is required to undertake an assessment of the council's framework of governance, risk management and control. In arriving at the conclusion, we look at the audits undertaken in the year. We look at whether recommendations made by internal audit have been implemented. We test the controls around the code of corporate governance, and we look at the risk management system. The report concludes overall that internal controls have been implemented and are monitored by management, but identifies a number of areas for improvements. These include strengthening internal controls in a number of areas, updating the existing code of corporate governance following issue of a new standard, reviewing the current fraud strategies and policies to allow full compliance against the new SIPFA code, and continuing to develop and roll out the new risk management strategies adopted within the council. These areas have all been mentioned within the annual governance statement. The audit committee is therefore asked to note the annual assurance report and note that the weaknesses in controls identified in the current year will be followed up in 15-16 and updates will be provided to the audit committee. Thank you.
Thank you. The functions appears to be well on the job in terms of productivity and conformity to the standards expected. Are there any questions? The report, Councillor Bryant.
Yeah, it's on the IT system. I've said this ad nauseum, and I may have read something about the backup system recently, but could somebody tell me if we do have a backup IT system?
Gary.
We do have resilience in our IT systems. The issue was that you go back to the proximity of the two main server rooms in the Dalkeith campus. That can't be fixed overnight. We are looking as part of the New Battle High School replacement as an option around that. So it's not something that, sorry. And also looking at overlaps with colleagues in East Lothian, as the director reminds me. But that's a major, to put that in place is not a straightforward piece of work. What you may have read recently is that we've been increasing the resilience in the two server rooms by replacing the uninterruptible power supply, the UPS. The team would talk me through the impact of that, and it's a bit like, I suppose I would describe it, it's a bit like heart bypass surgery for computers. You've got to keep them going while you take off their supply. So the bigger issue in terms of redressing the server room will take time and is mainly dependent on our options around buildings.
You will have noticed that one of the updates to the plan in the schedule is that we don't feel the need now to look at positive destinations in the schools area. I just wondered, and obviously this is excellent since for many years the question of positive destinations has been a challenge for Midlothian. Has there been any change in the methodology of calculating positive destinations that's contributed to this, or is it in fact a genuine improvement?
I'm pleased to report it's a genuine improvement, and whilst we haven't fundamentally changed the way we haven't fundamentally changed the policy, we've actually changed the way we do things. So, for example, we've had people in the street going and knocking on doors rather than sending letters saying, you know, you haven't appeared, you're not in a positive destination. Rather than just sending letters and saying no engagement, we're actually knocking on doors and actually tracking down our young people. And there's a new system comes into place this year, and it's not just about tracking them on leaving school and then the follow-up 6 months later. It's now about tracking them right through until they're 21. So there's a lot more checking where our young people are and their destinations.
So, if anything, the data is more robust than it used to be. Thank you for that. Can we now move on to item 10, the annual governance statement? Kenneth?
Thank you, Chair. This report provides an assessment of the Council's compliance with its Code of Corporate Governance. And as a Council, of course, we're responsible for ensuring that our business is conducted in accordance with the law and proper standards. And we do have a Code of Corporate Governance framework. And this framework includes a requirement that an annual governance statement should be prepared. This is included as part of the financial statements and is authorised by the Leader of the Council and myself as Chief Executive. And each year we go through an exercise across the organisation whereby heads of service complete a self-assessment against key elements of the code in order for us to develop the annual governance statement. And there's also guidance provided by Grant Thornton as external auditors. So the annual governance statement is included at Appendix 1. It includes progress on governance improvements previously identified and progressed during the year 2014-15, as well as additional areas of improvement identified for 2015-16.
Any comments? For noting, thank you very much.
Sorry.
Councillor Vink.
Chair. On 2.2, elected members and senior management are responsible. This really brings me to an issue that I always feel I have really had to battle with ever since I became an elected member, because while one is an elected member, one has got absolutely no executive responsibility. You are totally powerless, unlike a corporate business where you are able to flex one's muscle and direct properly. You can't do anything. And I feel when it says elected members and senior management are responsible, that should be rephrased. It is senior management are responsible and advised or cajoled by elected members, not the way it is described here in this paper. I'm sorry.
My understanding is that the legal position is the elected members are responsible. Kenneth?
Yes, I mean, I can't comment in detail on the legal position, but, you know, elected members do have responsibilities to the governance of the organisation. And you know, we can provide you with the details. I think when you first became a member, you got details of what your responsibilities were and the extent of these responsibilities. And these are exercised essentially through your engagement in the various committees and at a strategic level and an overview level rather than an executive level. But the responsibilities are there nonetheless.
This responsibility goes an ability to exercise power, and one has none. let me rephrase it. I certainly feel I have nil.
I think the constraints on freedom of action of councillors is a theme across Scotland and has been for many years. But you do have powers, albeit constrained by the legal environment in which we operate. Plea is noted. Graham, you have the subject of the PSIAS and the changes to report, item number 11.
Thank you, yes. The internal audit charter was reported to and approved by the audit committee at its meeting on 18th of June 2013 and 28th of October 2014. The public sector internal audit standards require that the charter be regularly reviewed and that any changes be reported to the audit committee. There have been three changes since the charter was approved in October, and these relate to recording that the standards are mandatory and must be followed, to specifically mention in the charter the monitoring officer's role in relation to audit, and to note that going forward, internal audit, along with the National Health Service internal audit team, will support the new Integrated Health and Social Care Board. So the Audit Committee has requested to note these updates to the Internal Audit Charter. Thank you.
I understand that last statement about health services easier said than done. Noted. Item 12. Graham, you've been burning the midnight oil, pages 77 to 157. Would you like to introduce the self-assessment paper?
Okay, yes. The public sector internal audit standards require that self-assessment of the level of compliance against the standards be undertaken each year. Any material areas of non-compliance be recorded within the annual governance statement. We've used a checklist provided by the Scottish Local Authority Internal Audit Group to undertake this assessment. We found overall a high level of compliance with some minor areas for improvement, which we have included as an appendix to this report. The Audit Committee is invited to note the results of the self-assessment, and internal audit will be subject to an external assessment in 16-17. Thank you.
So what we're doing here is laying the ground for the basis on which officers of another local authority will inspect our internal audit function.
Yes, that's right. But on top of that, there is a requirement every year to go through this exercise just to make sure that we ourselves believe that we're compliant. And as I say, we have found one or two areas there where we feel that we can improve, and they're recorded in Appendix 2, but I think the feeling is that they're quite minor, and therefore we didn't need to make any comment in the annual governance statement.
So the iterations of this in future years should be a bit less painful than setting the thing up in the first place.
Yes, it was certainly a considerable amount of work to go through that checklist, but hopefully in future years it should just be refreshing the audit evidence, so it should be a lot simpler.
I gather that it is now to be Highland Council that will have a look at our systems?
Yes, they're scheduled to come in. I think it's 16-17. We don't quite know when yet, but we'll let the Audit Committee know.
Are there any comments? That concludes the open section of the meeting. We'll have a short break to set up the systems for